Welcome to Wharton India Economic Forum's podcast. We are Wharton's premier India-focused conference. In these episodes, we will host eminent leaders, academics, and young professionals to discuss India's evolution into a prominent economic global power. Hello, Manish. Thank you so much for taking out the time to speak with us.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So, Manish, your career has spanned several decades and you've moved from India to US, back to India. You've also been an entrepreneur in India. I believe moving back to India after an MBA at Wharton might have been an unconventional choice at the time. And can you talk to us more about the guiding principles that guided you as you built your career?
I mean, see, when I landed in the US in August 1994 in Philly for my MBA, there was a front page article on the Wall Street Journal, which I have cut out and kept, said that India is more interesting than important. You know, I hope that journalist is eating the newspaper on which he wrote that, because obviously what's now happening in India is not once in a decade or once in a millennium, it's once in the lifetime of a country. But in 1996, it was clear that China was breaking ahead. It was not clear that reform would happen. But, you know, at least I was quite clear that, and I was at that point convinced about a 10-year plan not being 10 one-year plans or a 30-year plan not being 10 three-year plans, right? It was clear that, you know, luck and skill are almost impossible to unpack, right? I mean, I think in retrospect, luck seems to matter a lot. But I know a lot of lucky people who are unskilled. I know a lot of unskilled people who are lucky. And so it finally boils down to what, you know, Dumbledore tells Harry Potter in Chamber of Secrets. It is our choices more than our abilities that reveal what we really are. So luck and skill are sort of not as important as choices. And you know, there is some such thing as generational luck. And I think that people who have spent the last 20, 30 years in India have been sort of lucky in some sense. I couldn't have started both my companies, whether it was India Life, which I sold to Ewan Hewitt, and Team Leads, which has now been 22 years in the making and 6 years as a public company. It would not have happened in any other country. I mean, I have 350,000 employees. I've hired somebody every 5 minutes for the last 20 years. And that's a scale and a population calibration which probably would not have been possible in any other country, right? So I think, you know, obviously all of us are what historians call path dependent, you know, where you grew up. I grew up in Kashmir. My parents were civil servants, so I carry the gifts and wounds of a civil service upbringing, right? The gifts are quite substantial, frugality, but the most important gift is that you realize early in life that we don't live in a economy, we live in a society. Obviously, the wounds are risk aversion. My parents went crazy when I took a loan and went to Wharton and came back to India straight away, because, and I obviously didn't pay myself a salary that they were proud of for the first 4 or 5 years of India Life. But I think it's worked out in the long run. So my calculation of sort of moving back in 96 was that, you know, strategy is the art of creating an unfair advantage. I found myself having an unfair advantage in India. I understood the country. I had worked here 5 years before. And, you know, in Sanskrit, they have this word called sthanabalam. You know, it's sthankabal. You know, it's not roots. You sort of, you develop strengths in the place that you marinate in. And I had sort of marinated, obviously, for the first little over 2 decades of my life in India. And I was quite clear that, you know, that India was changing. It would be a sort of, like we say in India, often in reforms at least, that the shortest distance between Calcutta and Chennai is via Delhi or via Bombay, right? I mean, the shortest distance is not the same way. I knew that. And there would be fixed costs of democracy. There would be reform challenges. But it would be hard to keep a country with 1.3 billion people down beyond a point. So it was really a view that India in 1991 had made a decision to change its destiny. I can understand why 80% of the IIT Delhi batch between 1965 and 1975 left India. But I can now understand why 80% of the IIT Delhi batch this year stayed back in India. Right? And so I was sort of a little bit in between, but obviously lucky with reforms continuing. And, you know, Wharton was a really important part of changing the size of my thought. You know, my first company was my final project in 11 out of my 22 classes. I had five faculty as advisors. I came back in between my first year and second year to write the business plan. And as soon as graduation finished, I came back. So I think, you know, I had worked for 4 or 5 years before going to Wharton, but I went to Wharton knowing that I wanted to be an entrepreneur. And Wharton is probably the best incubator you can have if you know what you want. So I got many students to do projects on my business plan. I made my business plan the final project in many classes. So I think that partly my enabling was coming back to India was also enabled by Wharton.
And I want to touch upon one or two themes later from what you just said. But jumping in, I would love to get your thoughts. And this is something you've often spoken about. You've talked about India and the generational luck that you've had being in India between that period, between 91 and now. If you look historically, we have been as a country with a lot of potential, but feels like unfulfilled potential, especially before 91, like you said, most high quality people preferred to leave India and build their careers. You also talked about this ethic of productivity that's inbuilt in the fabric of, say, US or Western economies that has enabled them to get ahead. I would love to get your thoughts a little deeper on that. What has held us back and what has catapulted this country's to a level of income and to levels of prosperity that we are hoping to achieve in the future?
India was a child of two reckless experiments in 1947. One was political, one was economic. The political experiment has worked out spectacularly. The economic experiment was a disaster. The political experiment was giving everybody voting at birth. You know, no country before India had done that. You first gave it to the landed, then you gave it to the educated, then you gave it to the rich, then you gave it to women. You know, some women in Switzerland got to vote in 1972. So the difference between India and Pakistan born on the same night is that 3 million people in India win an election. 22 million people stand for an election. So we have created the world's largest democracy on the infertile soil of the world's most hierarchical society because of democracy. So I think we've got to congratulate ourselves on that one. But the economic experiment, it was really codified in the 1955 Awadhi Resolution and in the 1956 second five-year plan. Those were the most two toxic documents, which really kneecapped the private sector. It handicapped capital markets. It created public sector monopolies. It really said that the government knows what it's doing. The government knows where it's going. And it viewed the economy as a machine. And I think that's just an incomplete, if not a wrong view of the world. And essentially, if you come 1991, or even come today, our labor is handicapped without capital and our capital is handicapped without labor. And so if prosperity is, and I don't like the word fabric you used, productivity, right? It's the infrastructure of productivity or the infrastructure, because fabric implies cultural implications, you know. Cultural explanations for India's poverty are at best the soft bigotry of low expectations, or at worst they are racism. Right, we had some idiot economists talk about the Hindu rate of growth, right? He said that 1820 to 1950, India grew at 0.1%. And from 1950 to 1991, we grew roughly 2%. And he called it the Hindu rate of growth. Well, from 1991 till now, we've grown at 7% and we didn't shoot all the Hindus, right? So I would submit that culture is a poor or an incomplete explanation. It is really about productivity of five things, of states, cities, sectors, firms and individuals. You think of states, I live in Karnataka, my parents live in UP. Both states have the same GDP, but Karnataka does it with 1/4 the number of people. If you think about cities, you know, Bangalore, India's GDP per capita may be $2,500, but Bangalore's is $11,000, right? So if everybody in India lived in Bangalore, our GDP would be more than China, right? In some sense. So sectors are obvious. I mean, 42% of our labor force working in agriculture only generates 8% of GDP. While people working in software, it's only 0.8% of our labor force, a rounding error practically, but it generates 8% of GDP. So it's a very productive sector and therefore you have high wages. Firms, you know, India has 63 million enterprises. 12 million don't have an office, 12 million work from home. only 1 million pay social security. There are only 23,500 companies in India with a paid up capital of more than 10 crores. So there's a 24 times difference between our largest and our smallest manufacturing firms. Now, that is just a recipe for low wages, regulatory arbitrage, and obviously skills. We know the problem, right? 265 lakh kids take the class 10th exam every year, 105 lakh fail. 160 lakh the kids take the class 12th exam, 80 lakh fail. Of the 80 lakh who pass class 12, 50 lakh go to college and 30 lakh disappear. And obviously we have many challenges. So if we raise the productivity of our states, if we raise the productivity of our cities, if we raise the productivity of our sectors, which is really the only way to help farmers is to have less farmers. If we raise the productivity of our firms, which is ease of doing business, infrastructure, and if we raise the skills and education, you're starting to see the contours of a reform agenda, right? And that reform agenda really recognizes that India doesn't have a jobs problem. We have a wages problem. And because if you think we have a jobs problem, you'll throw money from helicopters, you'll mandate a 3-day work week, you'll take away people's shovels and give them spoons to dig with, right? Because it's bhuka nanga pyasa is the problem you're solving. While if you think India has a wages problem, you'll do formalization, urbanization, industrialization, financialization, and human capital. And that is the direction of reforms which we have turned. You know, the 1991 was very important, but it missed out formalization, it missed out education, it missed out banking, and it missed out corruption in some sense. So I think now that those areas are being tackled, 1991 was not insubstantial, it was just incomplete. And so now that we are tackling these four or five vectors, whether it is GST, whether it is the bankruptcy code, whether it is the India stack on financialization, whether it is the banking reform, whether it is the national education policy. So the most important or the only renewable fuel a country has is education. And in 1947, the second five-year plan or the first five-year plan really just missed primary education. So I think then, you know, there was a 1948 Radhakrishnan report on education. There was a 1968 Kothari Committee report. There was a 1986 new education policy. But they didn't break down the barriers between education, higher education, and employability, between vocational training. They didn't think about repair, prepare, and upgrade as a continuum. They didn't think about interdisciplinary education. So finally, I think in NEP 2020, we have a reform agenda, which aligns individual productivity. In ease of doing business, we have firm productivity. In bank reform and in UPI and everything, we have financialization. And obviously decentralization, you know, 29 chief ministers matter more than one prime minister, 100 mayors matter more than 29 chief ministers. For the, you know, first 70 years, the central government spent more money than 28 state governments. Only in the last 5 years are our state governments spending more than the central government. India can't be run from Delhi. In fact, China's genius was sort of 200 mayors competing for investment, which we've never had, that competitive federalism, which is starting to happen. It still needs a lot more fuel and a lot more room and a lot more catalyst. But I think we're starting to see the early contours of where states will compete on investment. And that'll be good because you can't take jobs to people. You have to take people to jobs. You know, I know in political imagination, we're always taking jobs to, you know, Bihar or to Odisha, but that probably won't happen. We'll just get Biharis and Odias to places where jobs are.
So you talked about productivity, that we need to increase the productivity across states and cities. One of the ways is formalization and financialization and increasing that. But do you believe it is a problem which over time solves itself? Or do you believe there needs to be active interventions to increase productivity? So for instance, when you talk about financialization, we talked about our banks and public and private sector banks and increasing access to credit, which has been a big theme across the board. It could be SMEs, it could be your private individuals. But do you believe it's the access to financialization and it's the lack of capital that's holding us back? Or do you believe then within that theme, it's more about letting those industries or letting those enterprises do their job, remove regulatory friction, and that hopefully unlocks productivity? I'm just trying to double click on that statement a little more.
I mean, the universe doesn't move on its own. You have to get every morning and push it. And if the lack of a state made countries hotbed, or the lack of regulation made countries hotbed of venture capital and entrepreneurship, then Pakistan and so or Afghanistan would be hotbeds of entrepreneurial activity, right? There is no state, so therefore you would have it. So I think many of us in the private sector in the early stages of reform said this grass grows at night while the government sleeps. I think we were wrong. I think that there are many things that the private sector cannot do. Obviously, the private sector can run airlines better, can run hotels better, can run banks better. But I don't think the private sector can do primary education. I don't think the private sector can do the kind of interconnected regulatory thinking that a good city requires. You know, we will have urbanization, as you said, anyway, but it will be good urbanization. Will the average taxi travel at 8 kilometers an hour in Bangalore, which is most people can walk that fast, right? So what is the productivity impact? On our IPO roadshow, I remember in New York, the slate was 9 meetings a day. And I, you know, called our investment bank and said, are you mad? I've never done 9 meetings in a day. But we did get 9 meetings a day done in New York. I don't think I've ever done 9 meetings a day in Gurgaon or Hyderabad or Bangalore, where I, you know, all my clients are. So I think productivity needs policy change. I think we underestimate how important policy is for catalyzing the super cycle or the virtuous cycle that you talked about, where good ideas and meritocracies develop and venture capital does. But in finance, it's bank to credit ratio will not go up unless we do 5 things. Our credit to GDP ratio is 50%. Now, China's 300% may be the wrong number, but 100% credit to GDP ratio we need to get to, right? That will not happen unless we issue new bank licenses, unless we erase the regulatory arbitrage between banks and non-banks, unless we fix the governance of public sector banks, unless we fix the governance of private sector banks, and unless we raise our game in regulation and supervision of banks. So I think that there is a clear agenda in every one of the 5 areas of formalization, urbanization, industrialization, financialization, and human capital. Now, is that agenda taking longer than I thought? Is that, you know, is there a fit and start? Of course it is. There are fixed costs of democracy, right? I mean, we took back the agricultural reforms because it was clearly a politically untenable situation. So I think productivity needs carpentry as much as it needs gardening. You know, there's a gardening view of the world that you just, you know, plant the seed and wait for it to grow. But sometimes, and that is also an important skill, but I think there's some carpentry, given our difficult opening balance of almost 70 years or 60 years, where we handicap the private sector, where we human capital and government diminish. So you didn't know, you know, we have 25 million civil servants in India. They would be the 50th largest country in the world. So we have to be careful with believing that the human capital there is what it needs to be. It isn't. They may be a meritocracy when they start, but they're completely no performance management, no training, no human capital. So I think productivity is a really hard thing to do at all 5 levels. And if you only do it at 2 levels, well, if you only do firms and if you only do skills and you don't do cities, states and sectors, then we won't get, you know, we're 138th in the world in per capita GDP. We may be 5th in total GDP. But COVID or even many things have reminded us in the last few years that per capita GDP matters more than total GDP.
Absolutely. I really love that analogy of carpentry versus gardening. I also want to double click on another statement you made of how within China, 200 mayors competing for investments versus that coming in a little more in India. And I want to talk about how at 91, both India and China were at the same stage in terms of economic development, but the time since has been a complete contrast. Can you talk a little more about what do you think they got right in that period? And what do you think we need to get right now?
Well, they just got productivity right, right? I mean, I think Deng Xiaoping, if there's anyone in human history who has brought more people out of poverty, it is Deng Xiaoping. You know, 700 million people moved from farm to non-farm employment. And that happened by them, you know, raising exports to 55% of GDP, by raising multinational involvement in giving them technology and capital. I mean, he was a very wise man, right? I don't care if a cat is black or white. If it catches mice, I cross the river by feeling the stones. You hide your strength and in my time. I mean, he was just a remarkable. So at some level, you know, I know Peter's the two views of history where the circumstances or leaders matter. I'm clearly in the school that leaders matter a lot. And I think what they got right was Deng Xiaoping having an antibiotic reaction to everything he had seen. And he was a part of Mao's sort of team, but he really became the anti-Mao, at least economically. But he was also very strategic because sometimes these changes are hard and there were antibiotic reactions to radical change. But he managed to navigate because there's a difference in reform. There's a difference between the list of ingredients and the recipe. Everybody knows the list of ingredients, but the recipe is proportioning, sequencing, coalition, alliance building. You know, the nazakat lies in sequencing reforms. And I think China got their openness to world trade, their ability to attract foreign investment, which brought technology, their savings rate was already high, so it was not just capital. I think China, in some sense, just got the productivity at all five levels that we've been talking about, right? I mean, so now, obviously, Xi Jinping is to India what the opposition is to the BJP, right? They're our best campaigner. You know, in some sense. So I think that there's a bunch of luck headed India's way because of what's going on in China. At least from my vantage point, I see many China factory refugees who can't leave China because they are very huge switching costs in their supply chains. But they are probably bringing their factories in India forward by 10 years, if not 20 years, just as a resilience strategy.
And just on this strategy of factories moving to India, there's big talk of China plus one as a big theme globally. And it's not just India, but countries like Vietnam and Thailand have also emerged, for instance, as some of the beneficiaries of that. Do you believe that it is here to stay? Do you believe that because supply chains are getting a little more inward looking, we hear of companies looking to make it more resilient and hence critical manufacturing moving back to the States? There was a big push in, for instance, semiconductor industry and just manufacturing chips in the US. Just that's one example. But do you believe as a long-term trend, it'll be more China plus one, or it'll be more some critical stuff back to the West and some benefits to countries like India?
Manufacturing is much less employment elasticity. The employment elasticity of manufacturing is much lower than it used to be. Right? The peak of any country's labor force in manufacturing was Britain in World War II. It was 45%. China peaked at 33%. America peaked at 33%. China probably peaked at 28%. But India is at 11%. Now, we'll never get to 45, 33, or 28, but 11% is the wrong number. We'll probably get to 18, 19% because make in India is also becoming make for India. So domestic markets are getting to critical mass at the same time that people are looking for diversifying their global supply chains. So I think that, you know, while Vietnam, Thailand, Indonesia are all really interesting, they don't offer the scale. They don't offer the double dipping of a large domestic market. And they certainly don't offer the servicization of manufacturing or the digitization of manufacturing. There's no such thing as a technology company anymore. Every company is a technology company. Right? And so the 5 million people in India who write software, which means we've hired 5 million people in 50 years is going to 10 million in the next 7 years, which means we're going to hire more people, the same number of people in the next 7 years that we hired in the last 50 years in software. Now, software is a rounding error in a 550 million labor force, but software is becoming at the heart of changing manufacturing, right? Everything in manufacturing is becoming technology driven. Digitization is not something that only Google and Facebook do. It's something that John Deere does for sure. It's something that Mercedes-Benz does for sure. It's definitely something that financial services companies, maybe tech companies or digital companies in the long run. So I think that if we were to think about India's opening balance for foreign investors, and you must remember 50% of India's foreign direct investment since 1947 has come in the last 5 years. 90% of India's venture capital investment has come in the last 10 years. So it's important to recognize that if we get our act together, capital is not a constraint. Labor is not a constraint. 40% of our labor force is Vela. And obviously, land is not a constraint. You could give every Indian household half an acre and they would fit into Rajasthan and Haryana. So we don't have a constraint of land, labor, capital. We have a constraint of how they combine.
You talked about how civil servants in India can form the 50th country in the world, that 50th largest mm-hmm. country in the world. That's a very interesting example of how we have 25 million civil servants. And there's this element of regulatory cholesterol that's been often talked about. In your mind, what should we do to reform this in the first place? If you had a magic wand to redesign the civil servant structure, how would you do it, especially given the complexities and size and scale of our country?
See, it is a complex debate. Obviously, as somebody born and brought up in Kashmir, I wish Patel had won over Nehru in the Kashmir argument, but I wish Nehru had won over Patel in the civil services argument, right? Patel considered, because he was looking at it from a state's integration perspective, I think, there were 562 Maharajas who need to be integrated. He was looking at it as the steel frame, right? And he often called the Indian service the steel frame. Nehru turned around and said, the Indian service is neither Indian nor civil nor a service, right? And I, so that steel frame has become a steel cage now in some sense. But it's not the 6,700 IAS officers, right? Everybody associates regulatory cholesterol with them or bureaucracy with them. I mean, there are 25 million. Where the rubber meets the road is also where the problem is, So corruption is not as widespread among the IAS as it is among the 25 million civil servants, at least in my experience. But there are three things we need to do. We need to change the structure. We don't need 75 ministries. Japan has 12 cabinet ministers. America has little over 20, close to 20. UK has about 28. Steel is kind of Vela, Ministry of Higher Education. Higher Enterprises is kind of Vela. So I think that there's a rationalization of ministries. We probably need 25 ministries. And we have 250 people in Delhi with the rank of Secretary to Government of India. We only need 50. Right. So I think that, so we need performance. So on the structure, we should learn from the army. If you're not shortlisted for brigadier, you retire at 50. If you're not shortlisted for major general, you retire at 55. And if you're not shortlisted for the top one, you retire at 56 or 58. So I think that our pyramid has become a cylinder. It needs to become an Eiffel Tower. And so we need to cut off people and retain a structure which goes as a broad base and a narrow top. We need performance management. If you treat Gadha Goda equally, it is the Gadha who celebrates and the Goda who gets frustrated, right? Any organization that doesn't punish its bad performers punishes its good performers. And most services, whether it's in IAS or the Indian Audit and Accounts, whatever, are ranked 99% outstanding. The people. You can't be, that's mathematically impossible for everybody to be above average. But if you have a system where 99.5% of people are ranked outstanding, it really is not healthy for the good performers. So I think revamping the structure to have less ministries, obviously retiring people early and retaining a pyramid, doing performance management where you know your top performers, your average performers and your bad performers is the best place to start. Now, obviously, we can start with training. Selection on average, at least for the top civil services, is a meritocracy. The UPSC is a very competitive exam. So I think from an HR policy perspective, you would say, well, why do we get these great people at the entry gate who then either become jaded or don't keep learning or become cynical or stop working as hard as they do in the first few years of their career because of the incentives they face, because of the culture they face? So I think a permanent civil service is a good idea. I think that whether a generalist civil service is a good idea, the generalists in a democracy are your politicians. So instead of bureaucrats, we need to have technocrats. So I think specialization is another next phase reform that we need to do. So I would go with structure. I would go with early retirement. I would go with performance management. And I would go with specialization as the specific agenda in civil service.
And just like our civil servants who need to be more specialized, there is a bigger need of, I believe, skilling in our country. We have one of the biggest labor forces in the world. But for instance, you talked about how the IT industry only hires a small, small fraction of that entire labor force. There's a much bigger force, which frankly is sitting Vela, borrowing your words mm-hmm. as well. So if we talk about this jobless growth that we have had, right? There's a lot of talk that, all this growth that we've had has been jobless. We are not really creating the jobs that we need to give. And there's two schools of thought. One says, let's go and make India the human capital exporter of the world, which would mean soft skills being exported across and people getting into higher skill jobs. There's another school of thought which says, let's ensure we have low-skill jobs in this country so that this bigger mass can actually get engaged and we can have a much broader swath of employment. And not everyone can work in IT. Not everyone can be a freelancer. Not everyone can export their soft skills as a way to earn money. And so we need a little bit more of low-skill labor. Where do you lie on this debate? Do you believe we just need a lot more of these low-skill jobs?
I mean, I think it's a false choice, yeah. I mean, countries like India, continents, we need all the help we can get. We need high-skilled jobs, we need software jobs, we need manufacturing jobs, we need service jobs. So I don't think we should have a choice here. I think if SEZs are a good idea, make the whole of India an SEZ, right? An export zone. You know, if regulatory cholesterol helps big employers, then it helps small employers even more, right? I have 180 guys in regulatory affairs. I don't think a small employer can afford that. So I think that if you get rid of the regulatory cholesterol, for me, it'll help the smaller guys even more, right? So I would suggest that let's just not make this for... The role of the government is not to set things on fire. It is to create the conditions for spontaneous combustion. We're offering a bribe in manufacturing. We called it the production-linked incentive. And I think the biggest takers of that are foreign companies. So I obviously people worry about PLI becoming the license raj, but I think it is needed to get the engine of manufacturing started in India, right? You will probably have the world's largest car factory, the world's largest mobile phone factory in India in the next few years. We already have the world's largest mobile phone factory. We probably have the world's largest car factory. We'll probably have many other things like that. But the whole of India is not going to become manufacturing zone, right? It's just 20 factories outside Chennai or outside Bombay or outside Bangalore or Jaipur or Delhi will change India's manufacturing destiny, right? In some sense. So I would say let's focus on making India a fertile habitat for job creation. Whether it comes from labor skill, high-skill manufacturing, labor-intensive manufacturing, whether skilled services, domestic tradable services, untradable services. I mean, if you have a cat, if you don't care if a cat is black or white, if it catches mice, right? So a country like India may be too much targeting. We tried that with the license raj. The Mahamanobis view of the world was the economy as a machine where you can change some parts, you can put some... You can wire some it in a certain way. You can grease it in certain parts. But I tend to think, you know, my favorite professor at Harvard is a guy called Ricardo Hosman, who says the only sustained predictor of sustained economic success is economic complexity. And, you know, he compares development to a game of Scrabble. Development is about making more words and longer words, right? The government provides the vowels, the private sector provides the consonants. Before 1991, we were making very small words and we were making very few words. Now, after 1991, now software is very economic complex. The people supply chain, the customer servicing. So India, no economist would predict that a country with a per capita income of $2,500 would be exporting more software than Saudi Arabia does oil. India did that the year before the war. So I would say that, you know, let's not try and pick winners and losers. We've seen that movie before and it's a horror movie and we don't like how it ends. So I would suggest that let's just make India a fertile habitat for all kinds of entrepreneurs, the connected entrepreneurs, the unconnected ones, the southern entrepreneurs, the northern ones, the big entrepreneurs and the small entrepreneurs. So if we have a number of statistically independent, genetically diverse tribes, I think India will be fine, which is what we had in technology in the last few years. We just need the same kind of startup Cambrian explosion in manufacturing and services. And I think we're on the cusp of that.
And there's also been a talk of India's demographic dividend being either a gift or also could be a make or break opportunity for us if we don't end up integrating this in a reasonable period of time. Do you agree with that worldview as well? Where
I don't think anything is make or break, yeah. I mean, life is not a... Defining success as a finish line or a mountaintop is a flawed view of the world, right? It's a river. You can never step in the same river twice. I mean, countries don't stop. We make mistakes. We pick ourselves up or we suffer the consequences if we don't sort of change our decisions. So I think China's trade deficit with the US in 1985 was $6 billion. Now it is 300 and $6 million, America's trade deficit with China. That is because of China's population and China's scale, and obviously China's reforms that they did. So I think that having a number of people in the world which is isolating where domestic markets is, are we going to be a less globalized world in the next 20 years? If we are, obviously large domestic markets are going to be important. But even if we're a more globalized world, having skilled labor and integrating into global supply chains is only possible for large countries. So I know there is a worldview that everybody can become Singapore, but you know, we have, Singapore has as many people as Chandni Chowk or Koramangala. So let's be a little careful in extrapolating that for large countries, China and India. We have a lot to learn from Singapore or in governance, from Finland in education, from Luxembourg in attracting financial services domiciles, but I'm not sure it always scales to the level that India has. You know, we had a UPI, a digital target of a billion a month. We've now made that a billion a day. I mean, 40% of the real-time digital transactions in the world now happen in India. So very few economists would predict either our software exports or 40% of the world's digital transactions in India. So I would say that our demographics are definitely dividend. They are an advantage. It's obviously demographic dividends are not population, they're productive populations. And I think we're doing, or at least there is a policy agenda to make our population productive.
This has been incredible, Manish. I think my final question would be, any advice you would give to students and young professionals early in their career, especially to the cohort of my peers at Wharton and across the US who hope to come back to India in the short to medium term to build their careers?
Well, I would just say it would be take more risk. You know, I went for our 30th reunion recently, and I would submit the saddest phase of middle ages is I wish I had. Because you can always change the things you did, but you can never change the things you didn't do, right? And so you might as well take as much risk as you can take. If you're going to jump from the 50th floor, you might as well jump from the 100th floor, right? The outcome will be the same and you'll have more time, right? So from my perspective, I think, what is the value of an option? It's, you increase the value of an option with volatility. You know, life is not a fixed income security. It's sort of a con option. So I think that taking more risk, I know there is a instinct to sort of say, let me repay my debt and then I'll take risk that I took for Wharton. But the amount of debt you have today is a rounding error in the amount of debt I have today. And that'll only go up. So don't sort of, so think yield to maturity rather than current yield. Take more risks because it's a unique time. You know, what's at least from an India perspective, what's happening in India is not once in a decade or once in a millennium. It's really once in a lifetime of the country. And the next, because of the 25 years of reforms have been compounding for 30 years, we have a bunch of China luck heading our way. So the next 25 years in India will be very different from the last 25 years. And obviously luck and skill matter, but choices matter. So I would urge you to take more risk and think about a 30-year plan not being 31-year plans or sort of 6-5-year plans. Because, you know, it's just the biggest rewards come from compounding. And compounding needs uninterrupted sort of long stretches of time.
Thank you so much, Manish, for taking the time to speak with us today. This was a great chat.
Thank you.
To learn more about Wharton India Economic Forum, please head to our website, www.whartonindia.com. You can also follow us on LinkedIn and Instagram for more updates.